You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome, all you weirdos, Cubs fans living on Mars, and cool villains being killed off in the uncoolest of ways. It is time for your landmark 90th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your weird science family. I am your axe-wielding host, Jason, broadcasting as always from the Wrong Turn Studio, high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And here with me is the not-as-yet-announced writer of the Abigail Brand / Sebastian Shaw miniseries, my pal Ruben. Hey Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Yeah, that's what
I'm looking forward to that. That'll be great.
Yeah, they have to give me that because they gave me this Fall of the House of the X garbage. And I need something to make up for that.
Yeah, we are going to get to that. The three books we're talking about today are Fall of the House of X number 3, Dead X-Men number 3, and Wolverine number 45. But first, we've got a little bit of news to talk about. We know there's only 12 more weeks of the Krakoan era, which should bring us to like episode 102, so that'll be fun. Beans have been spilled on the structure of the next era at a panel of comic creators at South by Southwest. All the details are out there for folks to read, so we're just going to hit the highlights. The launch event will be called From the Ashes. That's A-S-H, not asses like some other YouTube channels have been saying. Very rude of them. And the three launch titles that Marvel calls the core ongoing series of this era are X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, and Exceptional X-Men. So the first book, X-Men, plain old adjectiveless X-Men, to be written by Jed McKay with art by Ryan Stegman, on sale July 10th. And that's 5 weeks after that number 700 issue closes out the Krakoan era. So, Ruben, seems like you and I might get some time off there. I'll have to wait and see what happens.
I need to know, is that Legacy issue number 701? Or is that...
That's a darn good question.
Number one of X-Men, right? I'm still pissed about that.
It's going to get the 701 Legacy number. And this book here seems like the most traditional of the launch titles. These X-Men will be based in Alaska. The team will feature characters like Cyclops, Beast, which Beast, I'm not quite sure, but we can probably guess.
I think we know. It's not genocidal maniac Beast. Yeah,
we got to kill him off.
Yeah.
It could be Magneto in a Professor X-type role, Kid Omega, and Juggernaut. And Jed McKay is the writer. That's interesting because he's currently writing Avengers, Doctor Strange, and Moon Knight. So it seems kind of weird to put yet another huge title, you know, on his plate. I wonder if he's going to wrap up any of those earlier titles.
Yeah, people haven't really been loving the Avengers that much, so maybe he's getting a check to go elsewhere. You know, thank you for your time, but we'll put you on the other big book.
Well, I mean, Tom Brevoort's also coming from the Avengers office to the X-Men office, so clearly he's a fan of Jed McKay.
And granted, I want to say, it was very slow burn, but I'm enjoying it at this point. I think nice. I'm, you know, the steady contrarian over here at Weird Science, but it took a while, but it's got some stuff I like. And X-Men, I think, works best as a kind of a slow burn universe. So I could actually see him doing pretty well in that position.
Has there ever been a time when the same writer was doing a main X-Men book and the main Avengers book? I don't think that's ever been a thing.
Probably not.
Kind of interesting. Moving on, the second launch title is Uncanny X-Men, to be written by prolific Twitterer and occasional comic book writer Gail Simone, with art by David Marquez. It goes on sale a month later, August 7th. Marvel is spacing out these new titles just like they've done with the new Ultimate Universe books. Uncanny X-Men will be set in Louisiana and will star Rogue, Gambit, Nightcrawler, Jubilee, and Wolverine, Logan version. This is described as, quote, explosive superhero adventures. I mean, we'll be the judge of that, I think. But that's that book. I wonder how much like local Louisiana color they're going to give to this.
Yeah, it could be cool. These are both two solid teams. When I looked at the list of the lineups, one thing I will give a big thumbs up to is you've got two central titles with a mix of characters that have, you know, distinct personalities and big fan bases. And that's a great way to launch, right? It's not amalgam team with lots of weirdos who you've never heard of.
True. It does seem, very traditional so far. You know, I love the Krakoan era for, you know, taking this huge out of left field swing, having this big high concept. And this is not a high concept kind of pitch. It seems to be very much more of a back to basics kind of thing. Well, we have one more title to talk about, and it is a little weirder. This one launches on September 4th, and it is Exceptional X-Men, spelled with an E-X. And there's never been a title a Marvel book by this title before, as far as I can tell. So that's a new thing. Exceptional X-Men will be written by Eve Ewing with art by Carmen Carnero. Kate, or Kitty Pryde, will be the central character of this title as she goes home to Chicago, tries to leave the whole mutant life behind, and become a barista. Really, Kitty? You go from Red Queen of the Hellfire Club to making lattes? Protect dudes? I don't know.
Yeah, really? That's a bit weird to me. I could see her leaving it behind, but that's not the career move you make. At least it's not the one I would make.
I would think you'd... I hope she would have put some money away so she doesn't have to live on her tips. That's be a rough life.
Yeah, maybe she just wants the... I mean, maybe she's got all the money in the world, but she just wants to be in a place where she can socialize with the people.
Could be. This book also promises to feature Emma Frost and several brand new young mutant characters. From what Eve Ewing has said, it seems like she wants it to be something of an all-ages kind of book. She said that she hopes it's like some kid's first X-Men book. So this seems a little bit more off to the side, maybe not as central to the main plot, but, you know, we like Kitty, we like Emma. I'm curious if Tony Stark will be involved, or if the whole Emma and Tony thing is going to just be ended when we wrap things up.
Yeah. I'm also curious about Unlimited X-Men. Is that going to continue, or are they abandoning digital first imprint?
The website only, the app only one. Yeah, I haven't heard anything about that.
Because that's been said in the Krakoa era, right, very clearly. And although we haven't been, and I haven't been reading it, you know, all the time, occasionally I pop over and there's a story that feels like it's additive. Not necessary ever, but, you know, it felt helpful for fleshing out what was going on.
That Red Root story was pretty good. There's some other stuff that tied in. Right now, there's something going on with the Externals, and I've completely lost track of where they've been going with that. So beyond those three main titles, we get six more title reveals. No dates, no creative teams, no clue as if there'll be minis, ongoings, whatever. But the titles are Phoenix, X-Factor, Storm, NYX, X-Force, and, of course, Wolverine. There's widespread rumors suggesting that Wolverine is going to be written by Saladin Ahmed with art by Greg Capullo. So that'll be fun. I mean, it's funny because Greg Capullo always gets the top billing in these rumors. Everywhere else, they seem to list the writers first. But
yeah.
Greg Capullo drawing Wolverine, that's what has people excited, I think.
I mean, I hate to admit it, but when I saw that, I was like, oh, I'd check that out. I'm curious how he'd draw Wolverine and supporting characters, right? His art is so distinctive, and I don't know. It's like better Lee Field art in my mind. That's the way I characterize it.
Interesting.
It's of that era. Yeah.
So is that the title here?
Of Lee Field. I'm not a hater of Lee Field either. I just feel like he had a certain kind of blocky, chunky, you know, hyper detailed thing going, and Capullo is very much in the vein of that. But I've just kind of felt like it was a little bit better.
So is that the title that you're most interested in out of this next group of six?
I always like X-Factor, just because in the 80s/early 90s, it was a big thing. I really didn't like it in the Krakoa era, so I'm really interested in, you know, if everything's reverting to a more traditional book, like, I could see X-Factor being something that has characters I want to read about.
What that team's job is going to be in this era, right? What the purpose of that team is, or like even an X-Force team, what's that going to be?
And we didn't see Nightcrawler in any of the teams, did we? So I kind of felt like maybe he'd show up there.
Yeah, he's in Uncanny.
Oh, is he? Okay.
He's going to be in that the one in Louisiana.
Okay, well, never mind. I don't know who would be in there.
I mean, Wolverine's also in one of the other ones, too, so it's certainly he can be in more than one title. I think the one I'm curious about is NYX, because that was a 7-issue miniseries in 2003 to 2005. It was written by Joe Quesada about homeless mutants in New York City, and it happened to feature the very first comic book appearance of Laura Kinney. So is it just going to be, oh, we need a book set in New York City, so we'll call it NYX? Is Laura going to be involved? Could be fun.
Well, you know who we need? We need Miss Marvel, the most important mutant in the X lineup. She's got to be somewhere, right?
I guess. Are they going to keep leaning into tying her into the X books? Will that be something that they only did here at the end of Krakoa, or are they going to try to keep doing that going forward? Good question.
Yeah, I think it's a failed maneuver. I think they never should have done it, but I'm going to laugh about it until they admit the mistake and just kind of, you know, course correct. But I feel like she better show up in one of these books, because they told me she was a really important character.
And if they are doing it to try to maintain something more similar to the MCU, she is still going to be a mutant in the MCU. So maybe they're not able to retcon that too quick. Well, those are all future problems. And now it's time to discuss some current problems. Where's my ding sound? There it is. Our first book today is Fall of the House of X, number 3, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Lucas Werdeck and Jethro Morales, colors by Brian Valenza, designed by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. I'm going to be sad when this era is over and I no longer get to say design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. Last issue of Fall of the House of X, we saw the Bloom satellite destroyed by Polaris et al., Juggernaut rescue Krakoa from Stark Sentinels at an unknown location in the western U.S., Manifold being brought out of stasis by Rogue and Gambit, and Cyclops not actually get executed. So much like Krakoa itself right now, this whole book feels unrooted. Things, they just happen, right? Without setup, without meaningful character moments, without any sense of weight or importance. Now, Ruben, I know you love this book, and I'm just already crapping all over it, but try to restrain yourself.
I want to say this one. So I read this book. I was not expecting to like it given how I reacted to the last issue, but it's an important book, right? You got to read it. It's the, you know, important event book that's going on right now.
For sure.
And I think I had a little bit to drink before I read this, which is pretty unusual for me, but right, I was flipping through
it. Completely sloshed, not just a little.
No, I'm not really a drinker, really, but for some reason I was out drinking before. Anyway, so I read it, and I had just a visceral anger. Mm. Like, panel to panel, just things just pissed me off. And I got to the end, and I was like, I think I went into Slack, and I was like, I've never been insulted on every single page of a comic before, but I felt that way. This issue, just, I'm going to try to keep myself under control here. But I could literally go panel by panel and talk about how it feels like a slap in the face for anyone who's cared about.
Yeah, I wrote way too many notes about this. We could spend an hour talking about this really bad book, and nobody needs that. So we'll try to keep it a little more concise. Well, we start off with Juggernaut versus Orcus. We're in an utterly boring landscape somewhere in the western United States, and we see Juggernaut dragging Krakoa almost exactly the way Achilles dragged Hector around the city of Troy. Which is ironic, because Juggy then takes an adamantium javelin right through his own Achilles tendon. Maybe it's more of his calf, but I wanted to make the reference. Yes, Juggy and Krakoa are under attack by some more nameless, faceless Orcus goons, this time from the deck of a never-before-seen repurposed S.H.I.E.L.D. helicarrier. Helicarrier, yeah. That's hard to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here, Juggy gleefully kills one of the mooks by throwing splinters of Krakoa at him, which, that might be the coolest thing to happen in the whole book, actually. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was that scene.
So I'm gonna mention, here's two things on this where I start getting upset. So the first thing in here is he's dragging Krakoa. Why? Right? Like, Krakoa was under a net. He got the net off. The thing could move, right? We've seen it running like that.
Where's he going? What's his destination?
Yeah, where's he going? I mean, he was saying something like, I need to be picked up, but now he's randomly in a desert, sort of. And then I'm just thinking, like, a person drugged behind a truck, right? You kind of die. Like, this doesn't look like you're saving Krakoa.
Yeah.
You're just dragging it across the ground.
Krakoa's not enjoying this. It's not saying, thank you, Juggernaut. You're really saving me.
Yeah. And then this, the narration box is trying to, like, frame what's going on here. We have this dialogue where, I guess it's Juggernaut narrating it, but he's like, the mutants have been losing since the Hellfire Gala.
This is that, Duggan's been using this narration that I still think is going to end up being, what's his name, that reporter in New York, Ben Urich. That's still my theory. This is going to turn out to have been a book written by Ben Urich about the end of the Krakoan era.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, maybe that'll make me feel better, but because I'm reading this, I'm like, I read your last issue, Jerry Duggan. Like, every issue you've made Orcus look like complete chumps, right? Like, they got one punch in at the Hellfire Gala, and they've basically gotten slaughtered at every single conflict. Mm-hmm. So it didn't square with, like, the plot we've actually been given. And that was
again,
one of those things that just really has been annoying me.
Of this last part, there is no dramatic arc. There's no up and a peak and down. It's just sometimes they're really dangerous, and most of the time they're completely not.
Yeah, so it's like I can't really evaluate how much of a threat is. And then I turn the page, and like you said, this, now we have just a helicarrier, right? And I was like, where the hell did this thing come from? And two, like, it shoots Juggernaut through the leg with some adamantium harpoon, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was a weapon that had an effect. It was able to harm Juggernaut. So what do? We just bungee jump off the helicarrier and shoot him with guns, because why? right? Like, use another freaking adamantium harpoon.
But Logan left. We know he left thousands of these skeletons lying around, so that should be all they use against a threat like Juggernaut, is just pepper with adamantium.
And then just the art, right?
The faces on them, they're just, like, gleefully, ha-ha-ha, you know, killing.
Yeah.
But so we don't know who they are. We've never seen this team before. They're just somebody for to be targets for Juggernaut.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the overarching complaint of mine is it's very uneven. I don't know what's going on. Like, are they winning? Are they losing? Are they a threat? Or are they not a threat? And then, two, like, I felt like a lot of the other writers, especially Gillen and Hickman, were writing this complex story, right? Like, I understood this is like a more of like an evolutionary conflict, right? It wasn't like malicious. It was that humanity was worried about being replaced by mutants, right? Mm-hmm. And yes,
we knew that the AI were manipulating things through Omega Sentinel and Nimrod and all that stuff.
We knew we had some psychos in Orcus too, right? It was a conglomerate of like ex-SHIELD agents and AIM and Hydra and everything. And
everybody.
But at the end of the day, I didn't think of it as like cackling baddies, right? Like just laughing and...
Yeah, it was a bureaucracy. It was an organization.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bureaucracy. This does not look like a bureaucracy. This looks like...
Psycho killers.
Yeah, I thought there could be like humans that seemed like decent people, but they were really afraid of this, you know, humanity versus mutant things. And so instead of delving into the complexity and telling a deep story, which I felt like we had been getting through the Krakoa era, you know, people have been debating, right? Like, are they good? Are they bad? Like, is this something mutants should be doing or not doing? But it was because it was, you know, telling an interesting story where you could actually have those debates. This is just like, you know, these are the oppressors. They're just gleefully cackling.
Yeah, the complicated story has become a very simple black and white one-dimensional story. And part of this is because something happened in the X office to accelerate the ending. Clearly, it was supposed to go a little bit longer at some point, and then the decision was made. Nope, Tom Brevoort's coming in, the Jordan White's going out, and we're speeding things up because some stuff that was clearly supposed to happen never happened. So that doesn't excuse the bad writing here. I mean, on the other side of things, I think Gillen's rolled with that a whole lot better. But I think that is part of what's going on is just they were told, oh, we're closing up shop quickly. We gotta finish this up. Okay, moving on from that scene, let's talk about Araco next. The opening panel here is cool. We see a lot of our old favorite characters from Al Ewing's X-Men Red. We got Apocalypse, Red Root, John Ironfire, Bay of the Blood Moon. Cool characters. And Apocalypse is trying to rally the rest of the Iraqi mutants to join in and help out their Earth cousins against Orcus. The only character to step forward here is Woofer, who is that green-skinned mutant we first saw being dragged into an Orcus demutating facility in X-Men 22, showed up on Araco in X-Men 25, so he's been a Jerry Duggan character that pops up occasionally. Here he makes an oddly big deal about being from Chicago, and he holds up a piece of paper with a W on it. Now, Ruben, do you get this reference? You're a soccer guy. I don't know that you get this reference here.
Yeah, it's just like a sports thing, right? Let's go get that win. Yeah,
when the Chicago Cubs win a baseball game, they fly a flag like that above Wrigley Field. And why does that come in here? It's oddly deflating. We have this big stirring moment, and here we've got, I'm a Cubs fan, fly the W. What the hell is that? Again, it feels like
Jerry Douglas shakes his hand.
Is Jerry Duggan from Chicago? I don't get it. Okay, now question. How do you think Apocalypse was planning on getting all these mutants to Earth to help out? I don't think he had a plan.
No.
But the question becomes moot because at that moment, Manifold teleports in, brings with him Rogue and Gambit and an entire space station. This is the one called the Keep that was created by that creepy weirdo Jamie Braddock in Planet Sized when Mars became Iraqa.
Yeah,
Manifold, go ahead.
I was going to say just another thing. Again, watering down stuff, right? Like, I felt like we had a lot of complexity with the Iraqi, right, through Ewing's run and their culture and how they might react to these things and, like, and do they work as teams or not?
Go for Genesis or become more like the Earth mutants. Yeah. Well,
and they just brush over all that and you get one guy who's like, let's go get that W, and everyone's like, rah, rah, let's do it. Like, I'm not convinced that the Iraqi that I've seen up until this date would behave that way.
Yeah, I think a lot of them would say, you know, that's Earth problems. We got our own thing going on here. Let them deal with it. You know, if they're mutants, they should be strong. They should deal with their own things. But that gets cut off because now we have Manifold here with the space station. And he makes this highfalutin speech to the gathered crowd And I'm not going to claim to be a longtime Manifold stan or Stanifold, but this speech doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard him say. It's just generic superhero speech.
Though I loathe war, it is upon us. Man, that's the most Manifold thing I've ever heard.
Classic Manifold.
No one will command that you board the sword station behind me, but evil must be confronted.
I'm going to get that tattooed on my ass. That's
the best Manifold I've ever read.
Yeah, so everybody gets in the space station, and Manifold then teleports the space station to Earth orbit. Not down to the planet. Clearly, he can teleport directly to the planet because he just friggin' did that on Mars. But now he goes to space outside Earth, and all the Arachimuns have space helmets. I guess those were the space station? Okay. And then they jump out of the space station, and are they plummeting to Earth? Do they have parachutes? Are they just... Because if the space station's in orbit and you jump out of the space station, physics-wise, you're in orbit. Right? They're just going to keep circling Earth until they run out of oxygen. That's all that's going
to
happen
here.
There's
a very clear reason they teleport Sword Station Araco to, or Sword Station 2, right?
Yeah.
The only reason they do it is to make the F and X above, right? You cross the two Sword Stations and now you have an X and you're supposed to fist bump and say, oh, that's so badass.
Yeah,
and
because it fulfills Destiny's prophecy that we've all been waiting with bated breath to see her prophecy revealed. And if you don't remember the prophecy, yep, go ahead.
I was going to say that this jumping out of the Sword Station scene, and I saw this in a lot of this issue, like just callbacks to stuff that happened during Krakoa era, but it's not done with respect, right? Like there were a lot of things you could say about X of Swords, but there was one pretty badass moment, right? When there's this big conflict and the Sword Station appears, right? Out of nowhere and all the mutants like pour out of it to like,
That was, you know, cool. And people. That was a prophecy being carried out.
Yeah. So this to me is just like, oh, we're going to do that again, but
now there's two of them
in a shitty way instead of a cool way, right?
Yeah. So we turn the page and we get, I guess we're calling this a data page. It has all the, you know, the hallmarks and design elements of a data page, but it's just two reused comic panels with a color removed. The first panel is the cross space stations we just saw on the previous page. They're showing it to us again. Like, the helmet sticking in the corner. If we didn't get that, it's an X. Like, hey, everybody, they're shaped like an X.
Yeah.
And the second panel is Destiny making the prophecy. Although the prophecy here is stitched together from two separate incidents and two separate books, but here it's made to look like it happened all in one breath. Okay, so what she says here is that X in the heavens, it all culminates with a giant X in the heavens with the fall of the Krakoans. Now, that's what we're getting here, X in the heavens. And I guess the fall, are these Krakoans falling to Earth? Is that what's happening? I don't know how little are supposed to be here.
They burn up in the atmosphere during the entry.
And they're not really Krakoans, they're the Iraqis, but maybe some Krakoans are there because Orcus sent them to, well, anyway, whatever.
Yes.
And then we get, next, I see kings clashing in white, black. I guess that's supposed to be Shaw and Kingpin? We haven't seen them clash. I think there was going to be a subplot here that got cut. Because in Immortal 16, that was the last time we saw Shaw. That was months and months ago. That was when Professor X gave him some codes to start getting back control of the Hellfire Club.
Yep, and I was excited about that storyline because I thought that was really interesting. And
it just never happened.
Let's just ignore that.
Then it says, the death of the Red Queen. I guess Kitty stopped being the Red Queen and now she's Shadowcat. Mm-hmm. That's our death of the Red Queen. Not really a death. We get a Jovian bolt from the heavens. Polaris was hanging around Jupiter before she brought Nowhere with a K from Jupiter to attack the Bloom. So that's that. Stars ripped in half. That's Hydra Cap tearing up an American flag, then an Uncanny Avengers. False Captain. Hydra Cap again. False Captain Krakoa. The fool who speaks truth will pay the price. Again, this is a dropped subplot, I'm pretty sure. Deadpool was going to have some subplot about Orcus and his estranged daughter, and that never happened. So I think that must have been the fool who speaks truth. Is there anyone else you think would match this description?
That would be the fool. No, but unless it's here, some sort it's of this, sinister on the, reference.
Yeah. Well, which one of those would be the fool who speaks truth? Maybe, but again, it's put here on the page like, "Hey, everybody, we fulfilled this prophecy," but I have no idea what they're talking. Yeah. So as far as prophecies go, it's not nearly as much of a wow moment as it's supposed to be. So we're going to leave these Arachimunes in space, and we're going to check in on Dr. Stasis, because we need some more violence. Last time we saw Dr. Stasis, he was escaping from the Bloom before Polaris totally destroyed it, and he claimed that he had Firestar hidden away as a hostage. Now he's at some nondescript hidden base, and what the caption box calls, it literally calls it this, the middle of nowhere. We're told that if he gets on this private plane, he'll be able to disappear and hide his identity, which feels so artificial. He just flew in from space. He could have gone anywhere. But now he needs to get on this one tiny plane, this one secret base that, again, we've never seen before.
Yes. And why is Shadowcat there? How did she find the middle of nowhere?
Doesn't matter. They got to kill him.
You just hang out there. And Emma, too. Isn't Emma busy?
Well, he's not going to make his flight.
Emma got in her limo at some point, right? And I think that was around Iron Man.
Yeah.
And she told the driver, drive out to the middle of nowhere. I know there's an Orca space there.
Yeah, last we saw her, I think she was in Hershey, Pennsylvania, picking up Emma.
Yeah.
I mean, picking up Kitty, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then they knew to come here because they knew Stasis would be here. How?
Maybe it's middle of nowhere, Ohio? Who knows? looks more like a desert than Ohio, but who knows?
Yeah.
A trio of Lady X-Men are going to be here and torture and kill Dr. Stasis. First, Kitty beats him up and phases through his head to remove his psi blocker. Then with the blocker removed, Emma reads Firestar's location from Stasis' mind. That's fine. And then she mentally tortures him for 1 minute, but in a way to make it feel to him like 10 years of torture. X-Men comics, everybody. And these tortures are so boring. Dr. Stasis' whole thing is that he hates mutants. He wants to achieve dominion via post-humanity. But the tortures have nothing to do with that. It's just generic getting stabbed by Wolverine, getting eye-blasted by Cyclops, getting punched by Colossus, just dull, mostly generic, completely generic stuff. Surely Emma, of everybody, would be more creative in the way she tortures somebody mentally. She's done this before. Better
and surely Mr. Sinister, any version of Mr. Sinister, is not going to go down like a little punk this way, right? Not so easily.
He'd have another plan.
He'd have something, right? Like giving himself different powers with chemicals or having clone guys to assist him. It's implausible to me that he would just get, you know, wiped
all
out this
does
way.
All he does is he begs for mercy. He says, I have a wife. I have a family. Let me talk to Cyclops. She'll give me mercy. And that's not Dr. Stasis.
No.
And then after this torture happens, 10 years of torture, remember, Emma just kills him off with a heart attack like she's Kira from Death Note. Which reminds me, hey, listeners, you should also be listening to the Death Note podcast I do with Jim, which Kira is much cooler than, at least, than this version of Emma.
Yes.
So, while the torture was happening, Sync frees Firestar from an Orcus tugboat in New York City? Completely random. Did we see Dr. Stasis do anything with Firestar? I think she just disappeared from the book, and now she's back. I don't think we ever saw the way he captured her or what went on there, did we?
No.
Okay, I thought maybe I forgot it, but I guess not.
No, we didn't. It just kind of, I think they sort of alluded at him being skeptical of her double cross, but like he never took any action. And then just randomly is like, oh, I've captured her.
Well, she was on a tugboat, which I can't believe I'm writing that she was on a tugboat in New York City.
Yes,
but she's off the tugboat. And within a minute, because the torture only happened for a minute, within a minute, Firestar flies from New York to the middle of nowhere. And she gets to incinerate Dr. Stasis' already dead body.
Yes. How fast? Which, I mean, she's freaking Superman speed, right? Like,
I guess.
That is fast as hell, like flying from wherever she was to wherever she is.
Even beyond that, just to toast a dead body, is that supposed to be cathartic? It feels like the worst aspects of the old Ultimate X-Men. Did you ever read that old Ultimate X-Men where things were just like Juggernaut, you know, kills and eats people and... I forget what characters he ate, but it was just gross for the sake of gross, and that's what feels like goes on here. And it totally undermines the interesting content of the Emma-Firestar relationship. Back at the beginning of Firestar's, when she was first in comics in that miniseries, Emma was trying to turn her into an assassin, and her whole arc was resisting becoming an assassin. And here it's just like, oh, she's Emma's assassin again, which is just a total wreck of a scene.
And now they're buddies, right? They do the bro fist grab thing, right? Where you like, you know, hold
Emma drinks from a flask because, you know, that's what cool people do.
Yeah.
And let's talk about Dr. Stasis, right? Do you remember when he was introduced? He was such a cool character.
Yes.
Secretive, mysterious.
Yeah, you've taken all the best stuff of the Krakoa era. I wasn't on board with, like, having Sinister clones, but they turned him into an interesting, distinct character, right?
Yeah.
And they just flush him down the toilet in this issue, right?
That reveal when his mask was broken and we saw that he was Mr. Sinister, but with a different symbol on his forehead?
Yeah.
That was so cool. He was a bad guy, but like a cool bad guy?
Yeah, or even when he had the dinner with Mother Righteous, right?
Yeah.
And they had a conversation and he sounded very clever, right? Yeah,
all that is just thrown away.
They completely won me over. It's like this character, you know, like him as a villain. And I was like, okay, there's a reason to have him. He's distinct and unique and interesting. And then they just murder him for no reason.
Indeed, we do. Speaking of which, we have a little more murder to get to. We have our last strand of the story brings us back to Cyclops and Dr. Gregor. So Dr. Gregor has just saved Cyclops from being executed. Omega Sentinel still passed out on the lawn from Dr. Gregor's mini EMP.
Yes.
Cyclops can't see where he's going. He's wearing a solid metal blindfold.
Cool character just completely taken out like a chump, right?
Well, yeah, and Cyclops, he's been acting weird for a few issues now. He's almost like Yoda or like a Western caricature of like a Zen Buddhist. He just makes these statements. And here we're told he's memorized the steps between the execution grounds and his cell. Now, how often would you walk that path? Just the one time, right? You only get executed once. Weirdly memorize it.
He's that good.
And then he takes off the metal blindfold. He just takes it off? How does he do that?
Yeah, that was the thing that I started screaming when I saw that. I was like, they stitched his eyes shut. So they undid the stitches, right? At some point, they must have. And then they gave him a nice little pair of glasses that have like no lock on his face or anything.
He even says, I could have done this anytime I wanted to. He doesn't break it. He doesn't pick a lock. He just takes it off just because Jerry Duggan needs him to have the blindfold off now. And he couldn't come up with a good explanation, so he doesn't bother.
Which is not true, because the last issue I went back and looked, his hands were like shackled behind him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So another thing where I was just like, you're freaking lying to us, Scott. Like, it wasn't and this easy.
His back was broken from falling out of the burning treehouse.
But now he can walk, completely
swept under the rug. He got healed up there somehow.
He got better.
He
did the Batman thing, right? He just stretched his back and put it back into alignment.
So they're wandering around here. He has the blindfold off. He uses optic blast to murder a couple Orcus goons to death, because we got to have killing every other page here. Magic shows up with a convenient ruby quartz visor to restore Cyclops to factory settings. Cyclops has figured out that the AI members of Orcus are going to betray the human members. And it's just we're just told he's just so wise and smart that he knew this was going to happen, but we didn't get the breadcrumbs of how he figured that out.
And Dr. Gregor, here's another character that was deep, complex, interesting, right? Like, she was one of the humans that was anti-mutant, but ended up getting a personal vendetta because her husband got killed, right, during the repeated attacks on the Orcus Forge.
Yeah,
and to see her just be like, you understand where she's coming from. And I can understand the idea of, like, the enemy of my enemy is, you know, my uncomfortable ally, but she just comes across as like, oh yeah, thanks, you persuaded me. I'm cool with what you want to do now, right?
Right. There was no journey there. There was no arc. There was no way you could see, oh, here's where she realizes what she's got to do. And we're not going to get that, because Dr. Gregor's done after this issue. Magic transports Cyclops and Dr. Gregor to the moon. And I like the setting here being revisited, because this is where the Summers family lived at the start of their Cone era. Remember that architectural diagram where Wolverine had his own special passageway to Jean's bedroom? All the chatter about that. Oh, it was good to be back here. Would have been better if it looked a little more like it used to look, but it's a very generic, you know, mad scientist kind of place now. The Nimrod and Omega Sentinel are using this to do their little side project. But they're here because Dr. Gregor tells Cyclops, yeah, this is where Nimrod went. And Nimrod is here. Dr. Gregor reverts her House of X personality, which is when her husband became Nimrod. And it's like she's forgotten everything that happened in all the issues since then, because she just walks right up to Nimrod and, Nimrod twists her stupid head around backwards so she can see her own ass. That's nice. And she's just dead right there on panel. I mean, with the panel of her twisting her head being twisted around, I laughed at that. It looks really bad. It looks like a mannequin being put together.
Well, this whole thing is her like, I'm going to help you because I don't trust the AI. Oh, look, it's Nimrod. Let me go over there and smile at him. Like, I like Nimrod. He's my husband in part, right?
Dead. Right. And if she, exactly what she wouldn't do, but she has to die here, and so she's stupid for the sake of having her killed off. Once again, a really cool, complex villain, just wasted. We get nothing from her death. It's just, we're running out of time, gotta kill her. So as the issue ends, we got Cyclops, Optic Blasting at Nimrod, Summer House Habitat itself blasting off to go to, I guess, Sentinel City. Nimrod gets the last word, saying that Sentinel City is not an outpost or a mine. It's a tool to sterilize this hellish planet once and for all. So that's going to be our artificial, barely foreshadowed threat for the final two issues of this climactic miniseries. We got to defeat Sentinel City. So yeah, this is a bad comic. The concept of the AIs turning on the humans is a good concept, but it's Hickman's concept. It was fully revealed to us in the Inferno miniseries way back in 2021, 3+ years ago, right? That's when we found out Omega Sentinel sent to the timeline by the Trickster's Titan, all that good stuff. And Duggan is just taking that cool idea and playing it out in the most clumsy, dumbest way possible. I'm really disappointed. I can't blame the art. I think the art looks fine. Wernick and Morales make the individual pages look way cooler than the story deserves. Tired of talking about this issue, and I dread reading the next two. So I'm going to give this a 4 out of 10, and I'd go lower, but I need to keep some room for those next two issues.
Yeah, it's a issue 3. I'm going to give it a 3. I hate Very this fair. Issue so much, and not even sarcastically, when I read this, I was like, if this is how they're going to treat my fandom, like, maybe I just need to full-time commit to Energon, because it just sucks. I mean, thankfully, there's still the Kieran Gillen Enigma story that seems to be playing out with more respect for that concept. But and I can even understand the idea of, like, putting all the toys back in the toolbox. You do that, right, in a lot of runs, but you don't do it so haphazardly. And maybe I'm particularly offended because most of these characters aren't, like, Duggan's characters. So it really seems like he just throws them away because he doesn't care, right? They're not his creations.
And wouldn't it be fun to, like, be at a bar or something and have a candid conversation with Hickman and ask him, so what do you think about how all this is wrapping up? I know he's a professional, he's a company guy. He would say the professional thing, but I'm really curious what he really thinks about it all.
Yeah. It just makes me wonder, like, he's still around, right? Like, the goal is just to get out of this era, couldn't they have just paid Hickman to do it? Like, are they only doing it with Duggan because he was the guy who was writing the X-Men book at the time that this ended? It sort of makes no sense to me. I feel like...
Can you imagine Hickman coming in to write better. The ending? That's a fascinating concept, but that's not the way they do things at Marvel. Okay, moving on, we have a better book to talk about. This is Dead X-Men number 3, An Echo, A Stain. It's written by Steve Fox, art by Lin Yoshi, Bernard Chang, Javier Pena, and David Baldion, because every different timeline gets its own artist, which is pretty cool. Colors are all by Frank Martin, letters by Corey Pettit, and design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. So yeah, it's not a bad issue, but to me, this suffers greatly from middle chapter syndrome. Issues 1 and 2 had strong reasons to exist. They had, big plot points. Issue 1, we saw our team of Merry Morons succeed at their original task, find a living Moira engine Moira, copy her memories, but they accidentally give that Moira what she needs to hop through timelines all herself. Issue 2, they learned about Axe Moira's real goal, to go back to her very first life and ensure that eventually Moira wins. And issue 4 is going to be the big conclusion, but issue 3 doesn't have a lot to do. Fox cuts back and forth between two strands. We've got the dead X-Men, and we've got Axe Moira. These strands only come together in the very last panel. So we're going to start with Axe Moira, or maybe I should call her Weapon X. I'm not going to call her Weapon X. First, we see her visit Moira's 10th life, aka our main continuity, where she watches Cyclops walk up the steps to his Orcus show trial in Paris. That's a nice little touch of continuity, don't mind that. Then we see Axe Moira visit Moira's 3rd life. This is a life where Moira takes up scientific work at a young age, discovers a way to cure mutants early on. Presumably, that discovery is the moment that Axe Moira is visiting. This is also, if you remember, the life where Destiny has Pyro slowly burn Moira to death. That made such an impression on her, as it would. Next, she visits Moira's 2nd life. This is a life where Moira dies in a plane crash, and since Axe Moira is watching an airplane taken off, must be that final plane trip. Next, visit Moira's 4th life. This is the life where she married Professor X, and together they co-founded the X-Men. Here, Axe Moira watches a battle between the original 5 and Magneto, and isn't impressed. Axe Moira visits Moira's 6th life. This is a life where she lived for 1,000 years in the mutant zoo, only to be killed by Wolverine right before the post-humans were about to be absorbed into the phalanx. Axe Moira actually does something here, kind of. She fights Logan for a little bit, doesn't kill him, just fights a little and moves on. Her next jump is to her fifth life, where we will see her cross paths with the dead X-Men. And all these little pit stops are fun enough, nice to see, but ultimately meaningless to the story being told. Nothing happens. They're just postcards, right? They're enough to make me nostalgic for when Hickman was running the show and all these cool things were created. We do see enough to falsify one theory I had. I had thought that maybe Axe Moira had to cut her way backwards through the lives in order, remember, going 10 to 1, but no, it's more random than that. Although if it is random, she's having pretty bad luck, because we've seen her appear in all of Moira's 10 lives except for 8, 9, and the number 1 life that she's going to. So, Ruben, what did you think of all these little postcards?
I was interested in them, but I agree with you. It's kind of a doesn't-matter issue. That makes sense.
Yeah, it fills some space in a fun enough way, but you could skip this issue and not miss anything, I think.
For sure. But speaking of respect to, like, the past universes, I was kind of, you know, interested in just seeing, like, oh, what, you know, the different Moira lives and what was going on in those. So it's kind of fun for me just to see, like, oh, okay, I could see some of that stuff happening. But, you know, it doesn't add anything, as you say, right? All these worlds just are gone.
Yeah. Some sightseeing. Okay, let's talk about what the dead X-Men are doing. The cold open puts them in Moira's ninth life, where they nearly get killed by Apocalypse's host, but in the nick of time, they get sent back to the white-hot room by Rachel. And now we get a long conversation between them and Rachel that goes on for 8 pages. Not 8 in a row, because the Axe Moira scenes are interspersed, but still, from the dead X-Men point of view, it's 8 pages of just talking. And what the talking amounts to is that they report back to Rachel that Axe Moira's plan is to go back to Moira Life Number 1, and Rachel eventually agrees to keep sending them through the timelines to try to get there first. So exactly what first means in a timeline-hopping story, timeline physics and math, too complicated for me. This conversation takes place during Rise of the Powers of X Number 3, which hasn't come out yet. Rachel is in the No Place. Mother Righteous is there too, being a pain in Rachel's ass. Rasputin is outside the No Place fighting Skull Sentinels. We don't see Charles, but presumably he's off talking with young Moira in Life Number 10. That issue comes out in 2 weeks. So Rachel zaps the dead X-Men off into another Moira life. This time it happens to be Life Number 5. This is the life where Moira and Charles created a radical mutant army in a nation called Faraway. Moira gets badly injured by Sentinels, falls into a coma before dying of her injuries. The dead X-Men arrive during that period when Moira is in that final coma. We learn here that Faraway is on the moon, which I think might be new, because when I look back at House of X Number 2, its only previous appearance, that issue doesn't say specifically where Faraway is. We do see the same glass-domed city in a crater that we see here in Dead X-Men, but in House of X Number 2, there are trees outside of the dome, which makes me think it wasn't supposed to be on the moon, or at least if it was on the moon, the artist didn't get the memo. But it's on the moon now, which is cool enough. The Dead X-Men fight with the radicalized X-Men of this timeline, including Psylocke, Betsy Braddock version, and Banshee. Before the fight gets very far, Axe Moira shows up and does something with her axe to send everyone ass over tea kettle, both the dead X-Men and the Radical Life 5 X-Men. And that's where this issue ends. Nothing of real import happens. We got to visit lots of different timelines, enjoy a variety of art styles along the way. I think my favorite art here was the Apocalypse opening scene drawn by Lin Yoshi. No real complaints about any of it. I'm still looking forward to the conclusion of the series. But yeah, I wanted more out of this issue. Maybe this should have been a 3-issue mini instead of a 4. He didn't have... There was nothing to do with this issue. This could have been 1 page of issue 4. Just get them together in that same life at the end.
Yeah, your enjoyment in this issue is going to depend on how much what-if stories interest you. Like, I had some fun with the stuff where you have a Moira who's been kind of turned into an apocalypse, or, like, you know, she's his wife at this point, and then you see the host, which is like a bunch of replicated archangels, just stuff like that. I was like, oh, that's kind of fun. And then you get some banter right between the dope team sort of acknowledging that they're the dope team, which made me laugh.
There's a lot of these characters. I mean Frenzy, do we know much about Frenzy from reading three issues of this book? I have to look at the front page to remember who's all on the team. Cannonball's there. We know that. Prodigy's the one who has the smart thing going on. We get a mention of that Crystal is still stuck in his chest, because that's got to play out in the next issue, but everybody else is just kind of there to be there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they went to the Sixth Life, where that was the one where there's like a preserve set up for the last of the mutants, and you've got Wolverine and Moira living in it, right? Kind of like an Adam and Eve garden. I kind of just laughed about the idea of, you know, Wolverine attacks. But if this were to like be part of the original story, right? Like they have this fight and then, you know, what happens in House of X?
What does Wolverine think is going on here?
Yeah, exactly. So it just made me laugh and giggle.
Well, is she going to kill Wolverine here? Because if she does, then Wolverine doesn't kill the Moira of this timeline, which means it doesn't reset, which means that they ascend to the Phalanx and we're out of space and time. So does the next Moira life even happen? How does causality work in this multiple timeline situation? That could have been cool, but she just kind of fights with him a little bit and leaves. Well, considering I did have fun along the way, like you say, it's kind of cool to be reminded, oh, that was a cool thing that Hickman wrote. Oh, that was another cool thing that Hickman wrote. Oh, here's a cool thing Hickman wrote. But 8 pages of conversation, nothing really happening. I'm going to still give it a 6.5 out of 10. It was so much better than the previous book we talked about, but still kind of a nothing, skippable.
Non-essential for sure. I'll just give it a 6, but it was a 6 of like, if you like this stuff, you might like this as well.
Yeah, pleasant enough for sure.
And especially as like a palate cleanser to the other story, which also did a bunch of callbacks, but in a way that insulted my intelligence. I was way more positive about this one than Rise. Or sorry, not Rise, but Fall.
Moving on to our final issue, that is Wolverine number 45, Sabretooth War Part 5, X Marks the Spot. Now, this is the first issue of the Sabretooth War that has its own chapter title beyond just Part 1, Part 2, Part 3. I wonder why they decided to change that up. Maybe this will be the only one with the title, maybe they'll have titles going forward. Completely meaningless, but it's the kind of thing that makes me wonder. It is written by Victor Laval and Ben Percy, art by Jeff Shaw, who is my preferred artist in this series here. Colors by Alex Sinclair, letters by Corey Pettit. And we are very much in the thick of this story. There's a lot going on, including 21 separate characters listed on the title page. The Captain America Sabretooth is crossed out, listed as dead now, and we saw him die for reals in the last issue, so that checks out. The writers do a pretty good job here of keeping 4 strands of the story all chugging along. These strands are Sabretooth and Quentin's head on Krakoa, Camo Sabretooth and Lady Sabretooth on Station 5, the Exiles on their ship, and finally, Logan flying off to Krakoa on the Bluebird to rescue Quentin.
So I get the definitive statement that this enemy team of Sabretooths is called the Sabreteeth.
It does say the Sabreteeth on the page.
So I was wrong about that. It's not Sabretooths.
That is officially the plural of Sabretooth in-universe is Sabreteeth. That is for sure. So let's start with Sabretooth and Quentin's head, which is still in a box made of Orcus Tech. And in this book, Orcus Tech can do anything. Just say Orcus Tech, and it's fine. I'm okay with it. Again, in this story, there's going to be little plot points that don't quite make sense, but it feels like the kind of action story where I'm just going to let those fly past. I'm still going to point them out because it's what I do, but they don't bother me much. So Sabretooth and Quentin, his head, they fly to Krakoa on an Orcus ship. And we're told that this ship can get past all those Stark Sentinels around Krakoa because it's, quote, cloaked. Which is pretty funny because in that same panel, we see flames and smoke just billowing out of the back of the ship as it flies past a couple Sentinels, which I think the Sentinels would notice. I mean, you could say that, oh, they don't see it as an enemy because it has the right code, you know, kind of like, oh, it's an old code, but it checks out, that sort of thing. But it's not cloaked. There's smoke everywhere. Oh, well. I think it was just the artist didn't get the memo. Sabretooth is here looking for something. We don't know exactly what it is, but it's something in Forge's lab that Quentin has told him about. And it's possible Quentin is lying to him or misleading him. We know that Quentin is trying to resist, although it's not much he can do, because Sabretooth can push a button to punish Quentin if he knows that Quentin isn't really playing along. Sabretooth says that it looks like Forge destroyed his own lab for security reasons before he fled. I don't think that would have fit in the timeline, right? Because Forge was just forced through a gate, and he didn't know he was going to get forced through a gate. Sabretooth is only speculating here, so he doesn't know what happened. Maybe Forge is just really messy. Maybe Professor X, when he was on the island by himself, or maybe the Mr. Sinister version of him came and wrecked stuff. Who knows? I'm okay with just Sabretooth not knowing what happened and speculating into it. That's my no-prize version. Quentin leads Sabretooth into an ambush, an organic Krakoan mech type thing left behind by Forge, and we get our requisite fight scene of the issue. Doesn't last very long, Sabretooth tears it apart. Quentin says to Sabretooth, hey, sorry, my bad. That thing you're looking for isn't exactly here, it's straight down under Krakoa. Now, how clever do you think Ben Percy and Victor Laval are being here? Because this could be related to the Blight Swill we saw Orcus put under Krakoa in the Bishop Mini. I don't think they're being that clever, but if they do reference that, I would be very happy because it'll actually make that kind of important when it was just, well, I was going to say swept under the rug, it was swept under the island. But I do like the feeling here of Quentin not really playing along and doing his best to lead Sabretooth into trouble. I'm enjoying that a lot, that tension. Okay, now it's time to visit Lady Sabretooth and Camo Sabretooth on Station 5. A couple issues ago, we learned that their secret plan is to find Sabretooth's dad, Graydon Creed, from wherever he got lost in the multiverse at the end of that last Victor Laval miniseries. And they succeed, probably. I believe that this Orcus lab has multiverse tech. Again, in this title, Orcus tech can do anything. I don't know how they figured out exactly where in the multiverse Graydon was.
It's the Orcus tech, man.
They have a Graydon tracker. Orcus tech. Don't got to explain anything. It's like the Phoenix Force or the Speed Force. But Camo's Sabretooth, he goes through the portal wearing a tether, which is a cool idea, and he brings back someone they think is Graydon Creed. We don't get to see the guy, but Lady Sabretooth remarks that something is up with his face. So did Graydon get his face torn off? Is it not really Graydon Creed? We gotta wait to find out. But this was kind of a cool little mystery to set up. What do you think is going on here?
I think it's going to be Graydon. I have this, like, in the back of my brain recollection that Graydon got messed up at the end of the XL story, but maybe I'm remembering things that didn't happen.
I thought he just got, like, pushed through a portal. I don't remember what happened before that, if he was messed up first. Well, we're going to find out next issue, I guess. But now it's time to check in with the Exiles. They're chasing down Sabretooth because Oya, who is going to be in one of the new books going forward under a different name, she's going to be called Temper. But now she's still Oya. She got that secret psychic signal from her old flame Quentin, and they still have that anti-Sabretooth killing seed weapon to use against him. Now, this used to be called a death seed in the first couple appearances, but I guess someone in Marvel editorial realized that death seed means something really specific in X-Men continuity, related to Apocalypse. Remember, we saw that in an alternate future in Rise of the Powers of X, I think. So, it's a killing seed. It's not a death seed. It's not the Apocalypse thing. That's fine. They follow Sabretooth to Krakoa, but they don't have the Orcus tech to be cloaked against Sentinels. So one of the Sentinels guarding the island chases them, and kind of a long way, all the way up into space. Eventually, the Sentinel gives up the chase and heads back to its assigned spot around the island. This is a very coincidental lucky break for Wolverine, because the spot vacated by that Sentinel creates a gap for him to fly in with the Bluebird. The other Sentinels notice, though. They blow up the Bluebird, and Logan says he hits the eject button. Now, I would have thought that if you're in a plane or even a submarine, the eject button would have had, like, a parachute or something, but no, it's just a big old spring, launches its pilot straight up, no rescue gear, and fortunately, the pilot happens to be Wolverine, and he lands on his feet unharmed, which is very, very silly. But it is an awesome-looking splash page. It looks super cool. So I'm okay with it, even though it makes no sense.
And then Wolverine just outruns the Sentinels chasing him, which also makes no sense.
I mean, he's small. There's trees and things to go in between. That's fine.
Man, they are flying. They should be on him 2 seconds, right? Unless he's got the flash powers. A police helicopter can chase down a person on foot. These are Sentinels flying through the sky. But
I mean, they are shooting at him. They're missing. They're shooting at him, and he dives into a hole in the ground that leads to Forge's lab.
They just chased a jet into space and almost caught up with it.
That is true. They go just as fast as the plot requires.
Wolverine, when he's running, he's faster than a jet.
Put that in the wiki for
sure.
His
new ability.
So he goes down to the lab. He bumps into Sabretooth, and there's no fight because Sabretooth has Quentin mind freak Logan to thinking that he and Sabretooth are still Weapon X teammates, which was set up pretty well because an issue or two ago we saw how Sabretooth is kind of nostalgic for that time when life was simpler and he and Logan were just doing these jobs for Weapon X together. So whatever Sabretooth is looking for, he now has Logan for the moment working with him to go get it. And that's kind of a fun little twist here. I'm okay with that. I don't have a lot to say about this issue. The story is clicked along pretty nicely. It's a little more complex than it seemed to be in its first couple chapters, and that's nice. We got some mysteries to keep us interested. What is Sabretooth looking for? Does the thing he's looking for really exist, or is Quentin just, you know, messing with him? What is the deal with Graydon Creed's messed up face? Things I'm actually wondering about between issues. Jeff Shaw's art looks really nice. He draws fantastic action scenes, including some of the more intimidating-looking Stark Sentinels we've ever seen. That cool eject button scene. I really love that splash page. It looks awesome. Yeah, we got some minor plot holes, how things actually happened, a lot of coincidences. But it's not the kind of story that I'm going to quibble about these minor details. It's fun. I'm glad to keep reading it. I'm happy we get another issue in just 2 more weeks. I'm going to give this an 8 out of 10. Clearly my best book of the week.
I can't join you there, man. I'm just going to give it a 6 as well. I did get more hung up on the quibbles than maybe I should, but the art is actually good, and the twist at the end I thought made sense. They do a good job of the dynamic of like what Sabretooth wants, right?
Yeah.
He just wants it when life was simpler.
I think I'm impressed that the twist makes sense, the characters are acting like themselves, and I like that these 4 parts of the story are all moving forward pretty much every issue, and they're doing it in a logical way that actually you can see how they all tie together. So just that technical level of writing those different scenes impresses me. So that's what I brought me all the way up to. I could have gone lower in the 7.5-ish range, but I'm happy.
That's
to
fine,
this
man. I am happy. Yeah, I don't want to jump off, so I guess maybe I'm being overly negative, but it did. Some things made me annoyed. I did laugh at the one part where he talks about Sabretooth catching his scent. And I was like, yeah, it's anyone catches your scent, Logan, you stink. It's not a Sabretooth power to know that Wolverine
yeah,
is
smells like an NFL locker room. Yeah. Oh, well. But that's also canon that he smells like a livestock. Well, that is the last issue we were going to talk about today. Next week, we have some more stuff to talk about. We have Invincible Iron Man number 16, where we'll presumably see some Stark Sentinels meet their end, and maybe Fei Long as well. We get Resurrection of Magneto number 3 of 4, which is only 2 weeks after the previous issue, and we get to find out, I hope, is that really the Shadow King at the end? And the one I'm most excited about is X-Men Forever number 1 of 4, written by Kieran Gillen. The cover suggests, and covers never lie, it suggests we'll be returning to the white-hot room where Jean Grey is still kind of a mess after what Mother Righteous tried to do to her. So yeah, I'm really, really curious what Kieran Gillen has in store for us there in what is billed as kind of a continuation of Immortal X-Men, which you and I both really loved. So that is all we have to say today. I hope you guys had some fun listening to us and are curious about the next era that's coming up and about how this era is going to wrap up. We've got some good stuff, we've got some not-so-good stuff, but hey, we're always honest here. We'll tell you what we like, what we don't like, and we hope that we like the issues that come out next week. But until those issues come out, Ruben, what do you think our loyal listeners should do?
Read more Energon comics.
Ooh, change it up.